Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. My name is Kathy Hedge, and I'm a member of this fellowship. For those of you who come here from far away, or those who are born just steps away from here, you are welcome here. For those of you who dream of travel to the stars or just travel into your souls, you are welcome here. If you feel dwarfed by space and time or believe that you are a greater part of the whole, then you are welcomed here. We celebrate the universe of beliefs, the reality of facts, and the joys of discovery here. Welcome. And please take a moment to say hello to those in your interstellar system. Thank you. What a lovely group. I like to journey around the sun with you. Makes it fun. This is who we are, for those of you who are new to us. We are a fellowship of Unitarian Universalists, and we meet to express our individual beliefs and religious convictions. We belong to the national organization, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. We have no creed, prophet, or sacred book, but we agree on 7 principles, and those are listed on the back of our bulletin. And visitors, you are invited to join us after service for coffee. If you are new to the fellowship or have a guest that you would like to introduce, we would love to have you introduce yourself, but we would like you to wait for the microphone so that everybody can hear you. So do we have anyone who would like to introduce their friend or guest? Thank you, Doug.
This is my friend Jordan Coulson. I'm glad she's here.
All right, thank you. Any announcements that we have, you'll find in the bulletin here. I don't have any additional announcements. So would you please join us for our opening song? This was Larry's favorite, number 343, A Fire Mist and a Planet. Number 343.
Charm of golden rod, some people call it all.
Others call it God. Like God's own sea beach,
so new and and thin. Into our hearts high yearnings come welling, surging in. Come from the mystic ocean whose rim no food. Some people call it longing, others call it God. A sentry lone and frozen, a mother starved for her brood, and Socrates dread hemlock, and Jesus on the rood, and millions who, though nameless, the straight hard pathway trod. Some call it consecration, others call it God.
The Sky Could Send You, a poem by Donna Mussini. Tonight in the shadow of alien green, the dark around us breathing, a man points out the obvious stars. I stand beside him under the cosmic mess. Clutter, I whisper. You could connect anything, join any dots to form a dipper or belt. My eyes cannot find any cluster twice. What I want to say is, you could lose yourself in a sky like this, looking into the flicker of history, already dead to somewhere else. There was so much time in a sky like this, in our silence and the strangeness of these ancient stars. Islands of light, they remind me of my dead friends, my infidelities. This night with its shadows and monsters is too big for me. Random, irrational as love, no matter what pictures we pretend to find. Is this why we make a dipper or belt? To contain it? Make it familiar? Where are the gods in a sky like this? It is very clear, the man beside me is saying, but I am lost. I see nothing. Night looks like a broken thing, as though an enormous lamp had shattered, scattering pieces of itself throughout the dark. Is this why lovers reach to touch one another when the sky could send you so far into yourself you would become someone else? The moon is beautiful, I read somewhere, but dead. I look up into the cavey dark, the silence. I have never understood the positions of stars, never seen either dipper, never traced Orion's belt, seen a bull, a bear, an arching centaur in the sky. Patternless as measles, the stars are. Oh, how I have wanted things to be clear. Love, promises, the random dark. Beneath the curved horn of a dead moon, I think, listen to him, watch. This might be faith that the names name. This might be hope or delusion. And maybe I do begin to see the beginnings of a handle there, just there, where the lights are slightly brighter. Now we'll have our chalice lighting, or Chris. Up on the moon is a plaque inscribed, "Here, men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon." Good, thank you. First set foot upon the moon, July 1969 AD. We came in peace for all mankind. Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong had the dream of the stars in their eyes and the dream of peace. Chris lights this chalice in hope that we can each take our journeys and bring peace along with us. Now is the time we share our joys and concerns. If you have something you'd like to share with the group, please wait for the microphone.
Tomorrow is Charlie and my 40th wedding anniversary.
I'm Jane Pelletier. This week I'm going to Massachusetts and on Saturday, Rhode Island, where my niece will be married to her partner. And so this will be my second same-sex marriage within a month. I can't imagine it'll be as much fun as Michael and Charles's was.
Chris Bailey, and on Friday, I had the honor of attending the naturalization ceremony for my good friends, Peter and Yasmin Gavigan, or Gavigan, as they were called.
Hi, Katie Kingry Page. I wanted to share a joy. My family has a longtime friend in Kansas City who'd had a really rough year. She was laid off from her work. She found out she was losing her apartment because the landlord sold the building and gave her 30 days notice to move out. Life seemed really hard, and we'd been spending a lot of time trying to support her. And out of the clear blue, someone who she'd done a great kindness to 15 years ago bought her a house and gave it to her. And I just want to share that. It was wonderful.
Last week, I announced that my brother had had a stroke, and we went to Wichita and spent the day last Monday. But he came home on Thursday, marched out, got on his tractor, and went off and mowed the roadside. And we spent yesterday with him, and he seems unchanged, except that I think he's so glad to be alive and whole. Remarkable recovery, a testament to the quality of medical care out there in the middle of nowhere. So it all is turning out well.
Jim Chanteau. Well, I have I'll announce the concern first and the joy second. Concern is that The municipal band that I'm playing is playing at 9:30 tomorrow morning in a Sunset Cemetery. I hate getting up that early. But we'll be playing the same concert at 7:30 over in the Arts in the Park series. So you can come hear us at a time when I'll be awake.
Yeah. Ann Marchin, and I'm very lucky to have my daughter and her husband and their two kids staying with us, but Lucy's going on 9 years old, and we had a very suspenseful morning, but she finally got the tooth out, so.
I want to be Superman. I want to be Spider-Man.
Hi, my name is Sonia Birdwell, and this is my son, Benjamin. I am currently in a batter shelter right now, and I found this church. I hope this is my first time being here. I just feel more comfortable to be in a smaller community. I've been in several churches, and as of right now, I feel comfortable. Every prayers count, and so I hopefully I get a new apartment, just me and my son. So, and move on to a new journey and leave the past behind. So,
Betty Banner, I have a concern for all of us, and that is that it is amazing and distressing to me that in light of the most recent shootings in California, that our papers, both the Kansas City Star and the Manhattan Mercury, did not even deem this to be news. I think it is tragic that such events have become so common that they are no longer notable.
Thank you very much for expressing your thoughts, and for those not yet spoken, we hold you in our hearts. And now, children, it is time. Would you like to come forward? And I have a story to tell you. All right. You can all come up close because I have some pictures to show you, too. Right up here.
Okay, wonderful. And while I'm talking, you can pass this around just to hold it on your forehead for a moment and then pass it to the next person. Okay? Here you go. And you can put it up on your forehead like that. And then, oh, you're the Statue of Liberty now, not Superman. That's wonderful. You're Star Superman. All right. Well, I have a picture to show you.
I just was close to a star.
All right. Well, I have this charming picture. Who can tell me, I mean, how many of you have ever touched this right here? Ever touched that? Oh, you blowed it out. All right. What would happen if you touched it?
If you got too close to, you would burn.
Absolutely. But have you, you wouldn't even get close. No, you would melt right into a little puddle of, I don't know what it would be, of plasma. Hmm?
You get burned, you got fire.
Yes, you would. What is this? The sun, that's right. Up. Isn't that a fine picture? I love that. Okay, do you know that there's tornadoes on the sun? Yeah, did you see that picture on the television when they showed the video of the tornadoes on the sun? Ooh, it's worth looking up if you haven't seen it yet. But do you know that you touch something from this every day and you are touching it right now? What do you touch that comes from the sun? What?
Tornadoes.
Oh, tornadoes, actually. It causes some of the weather patterns. Absolutely. What else? What do you touch?
Sunshine.
Sunshine! And every time you eat, you're eating a little bit. Every time you eat some food, you're eating some sunshine in that plant or in that animal. So it's pretty important for us. Would life exist? Oh.
Rainbows.
Rainbows. Ooh. This is why this is fun to do, folks. Okay. All right.
Your finger would get burned.
It sure would. It wouldn't. Your whole body wouldn't make it. How about you?
Everything could blow up if there was a big tornado.
It could, but hopefully it would miss us. Okay, this is the last one, and then I'll skip on to the story, okay?
That's because you get burned all your body.
Your whole body, yes. Even our whole planet if it went too close, right? Now, did you know that suns are, in a way, they have life cycles like we do, that they're born, and then they live, and then they die? Okay, so I have a couple of pictures for you. Here is the place where stars are born. Now, something right in the middle, that's a star nursery, right there. Yeah, that's where they begin. That's their home. That's their birthplace. Absolutely. This stars are born in vast clouds of gas called nebula. The Orion Nebula, which is part of which is seen here, is easily visible to us when we go outside and look. The Trifid Nebula is divided by dark bands, and that's dust. And in that dust is where planets can begin. How about that? And then, oh, here's the one. So they live a good long life, billions and billions of years, some not so long. Some of them are burned so hot that they don't live nearly as long. And we're going to talk a lot more about stars today. Larry's going to talk to us about stars. But here is, at the end of a star's life, some of them just burn themselves up and leave a little cloud like that. And right in the middle is something called a dwarf star. It might only be that big, but it's very, very strong, has huge energy. And then some of them are so big, you know what they do? Explode. What do they do?
Explode like a bomb.
Yes, and that's exactly what they are. And they explode, and we can see those explosions. They're so big that they cover a whole galaxy of thousands of millions of stars, and that light goes out through the whole thing.
If when the sun dies, it will turn into a red giant.
Ooh, it sure can. Some of them become red.
In the middle of every star, there's a black hole.
Ooh,
not everyone, but many of the, especially these big ones. But Larry can tell you a lot more. He knows more than I do about that. So he's a good person to ask, because I don't want to lead you wrong. Okay? Yes.
You get burned. You burn yourself hot, very hot.
Very hot. Yeah, and we don't want that to happen. So I think I'm staying right here. Somebody gave me an opportunity to go on a spaceship that had good insulation. I might check it out, but okay, how about you?
If a red giant can explode, I would not get close.
I wouldn't get close to it either, absolutely. Okay, I have one more thing I want to tell you, okay? So now, when you look out at the stars, you look out there, and they're little teeny tiny things, right? Don't they look little tiny? But are they?
No.
How big are they?
Pretty big.
In fact, our star is just an average, normal star. Just a sort of a, you know, not too big, not too small, not too strong, not too weak. It's just kind of an average, boring star. But to us, is it boring? No. But if somebody way out there at the edge of the universe looked at us, our star would look just like the ones we see at night. But we know that it's very, very special. Okay, so the star that we look every day that gives us our energy and our sunlight and our food and is so beautiful to look at, well, hold on to it for 10 seconds, okay? The thing is, our star is very, very special and unique. And you know what? So are each one of you. Even though there's billions and billions and billions of people, there is absolutely, how many of you?
Because there's a lot of people.
But if just somebody like you, how many?
One.
Just one. How many of you?
One.
How many of you?
One.
Two.
Two. Are you? You're a twin, right? But is your twin exactly like you?
Nope.
Nope.
We're different.
You're different, absolutely. How many of you?
One.
Louder.
One.
Yes. And how many of you?
Three.
Three of you, because you're three. I understand. Very good. Well, since you're also very special, we're very glad you're here, because you are the stars in your, the people that you love and the people around you, you are the stars in their eyes. And I took longer than 10 seconds, but what was the last thing you wanted to say?
The stars... Some stars shoot around, and we call them asteroids. It gets dark. We see the moon.
Yes, that's right.
If there's a star going crossed, if it's a meteor, it's a shooting star.
For one, in the daytime, you can see the moon if you look for it. And in two, in the daytime, there are stars. You just can't see them because of the sun.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, all you young scientists and dreamers, for sharing the story time with me. And we'll sing you out. And we have, who's going to do the candle? Okay. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all we do.
Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too.
Learn in love, grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Well, good morning. I'm Larry Weaver, longtime member of the fellowship, teach physics at Kansas State University. About a month ago, Kathy called and asked if I would do a program on what's going on in stars. Oh, excuse me. Sorry. I'm excited about this. That was wonderful. my Lance. Well, when Kathy asked me to talk, I said in the last year or so, there have been, in my view, two big developments in our understanding of the universe, and so I'm going to talk to you about that this morning. the two discoveries are, excuse me, on the one hand, there are lots of planets out there. Lots of stars have other planets, have planets around them just like our sun does. And the other thing is that a prediction of a theory about the very early universe has been confirmed, a prediction, that is. So let me start. And you're going to have trouble here, because Lily, what we're going to do is swing round and round. I mean, so first, let's see if we can swing round and round real fast. Okay, like that. That's good. Okay, good. Now, while we're swinging round and round real fast, I think we better start right here. We're going to go in that direction. Okay, ready? Here we go. And y'all watch. Now, thank you, Lily. Next, Kathy, you and I are going to do that.
I get dizzy. Okay.
All right. Are you? Well, first, let's practice.
Okay.
Going once round and around fast. Okay. Good. All right. Now, ready?
Okay.
Here we go. We're going to go that
way.
Now, watch.
So.
Watch what happens.
All right. Here. How about if we do this?
Okay.
Okay.
That's safer. Good.
All right.
All right. Here we go. Let's go.
Woo-hoo!
Okay. Great. Now you sit down before you fall.
All right.
Now the thing I hope you noticed is that when Lily and I were doing it, I was sometimes right here, and sometimes way over here, sometimes there. When Kathy and I did it, we both went around that way. Lily made a pretty big circle. I made a pretty small circle. Let me show you the same thing happening here. And what was happening was that Lily and I and Kathy and I were revolving around our common center of gravity. And let me show you something right here. This orange thing, ball, is approximately at the center of gravity of this rod that's got, you can imagine, a star on one end and a planet on the other. When I throw this, I'm going to do it twice. So first, notice the complicated motion. But watch this time. Just keep your eye on the orange ball. Don't worry about everything else. Just look at the orange ball. Now, did you notice how the orange ball moved so smoothly? The orange ball, the center of gravity of this system, moves very smoothly and simply. Now, when I was a boy, we all speculated about planets around other stars, but we couldn't see them in a telescope. They were just too far away. And so people had an idea. You know, If a star has a planet, then as the star and planet rotate around each other, the center of gravity of the star and planet should move smoothly through the universe around our galaxy, but the star itself should wobble a bit. So that as this thing rotates, if this piece is the star, for example, while the center of gravity is moving smoothly, the star itself would wobble. And so we tried to look for that. People thought, for example, that a star called Barnard's star showed the right kind of wobble. But in retrospect, it turns out we failed. The wobbles are there, but they're just too small. We couldn't see them, okay? And that's, by the way, illustrates an important piece of science. You have a good idea, but it might not work. Even though the idea might be correct, it might just be that the effect you're dealing with is too small for you to see with the current situation. So that's not how planets are discovered. However, the technology has developed, and other ideas have come into play. Tom, would you show slide number one, or A, sorry. So, now what you're going to see is an artist's drawing, I'm sorry to say, but it illustrates the point. Well, what I hope you're going to see. Pardon? Oh, it's coming on? Okay, all right. Well, here's the idea. The idea is that if a planet has a star, if a star has a planet, excuse me, then when the planet moves in front of the star, between us and the star, the light from the star should dim a bit because the planet will obscure it a little bit. And so this is called the transiting light curve. And here's an artist's conception of a very large planet that revolves around a star called Gliese 1214 or something like that. And you can see that if the planet came between us and the star, then the light from the star would be dimmed, just as the light from the screen is dimmed as I pass between the star and the observer out there, okay? This, of course, is not going to work all the time if you're the Earth and this thing is the star, then if the rotation is this way, it'll never dim. On the other hand, if the rotation is this way, then the star is bright, 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 bright. Remember, this end is the star. Bright, 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 dim, dim, bright. Okay? So the light from the star will periodically dim. If the stars are lined up, if the planet's orbit is lined up so that it passes between us and the star. One of the amazing things is that when that happens, as the planet moves in front of the star, then the light from the star goes through any atmosphere the planet might have. And so we actually learn about what's in the atmosphere of that dark object transiting in front of the star. So that's one way that planets are being discovered. in principle, you might say, well, why couldn't people do that a long time ago? The problem is that a long time ago, an astronomer would get a night at the telescope, aim the telescope at a star, measure the light curve. Maybe he'd do it again the next night, maybe the next night. But if the planet happened to be lined up and it went by during the day, of course, didn't see it. Furthermore, looking at one star at a time just takes too long. And so today we have a spacecraft, the Kepler mission, that has a telescope and a computer screen with pixels where all the stars are. And so literally thousands of stars every second are being sampled constantly. And if one of the pixels dims or brightens, then that's a pixel that people can focus on. And so Kepler has discovered more than 1,000 planets this way. Now, some of them are false positives. I mean, because stars do change brightness. But we know about the stars that do that. And so many of those can be ruled out. But Tom, if you'll give us the second slide. This is one of the planets found by the Kepler mission. That's 78b. In fact, the b means it's the second planet around that star that has been found. And again, this is an artist's conception. No telescope in the world can image a planet like that around a distant star. They're just too far away. But although the wobbles of the star's orbit cannot be observed, the speed of the wobbles can, because you've all heard of the Doppler effect. When a police siren is moving towards you, it's going, whoo, and as it moves away from you, it's whoo. That shift in pitch produced by the speed of the car has its analog in the change in color of the light from a star. And so if a planet is orbiting a star, then the wobble of the star, as it's sometimes moving towards us, the light shifts a little bit, it's a tiny bit bluer. When the star is moving away, it's a tiny bit redder. And that tiny alteration in the color of the light enables you to say, hey, there must be something orbiting that star. And in this case, this particular planet was first found by the transit time and then looked at more closely by a telescope in Hawaii, and we could discover from the speed of the wobbles how massive the planet is. And so now, from the transit time, the dimming, how much the starlight dimmed, we know how big the planet is. From the speed of the wobbles, we learn how massive the planet is. So we can figure out the density, and it's about 2 times that of Earth. There's a planet made of rock, okay, like us. So there are two of the ways, and there are others. In fact, Tom, if you'll go to the third slide, I said when I was a boy you couldn't, no planets could be seen in a telescope because they were too far away. Well, these planets are seen by the infrared light they emit, but those planets are big. They are many, many times bigger than Jupiter. And furthermore, they're orbiting their orbits are about the size of the orbit of Pluto here in our solar system in comparison to the star. The starlight has been blocked out by a disk, and the infrared observations of those planets are what you're looking at. And so eventually there becomes a kind of question. Are we looking at a small planet, at a big planet, or a small star? Well, the trick is that a star is something that gets hot enough in the core to actually produce its own light and not simply be hot because it's left over, the heat left over from its formation. and so these are pretty well thought to be planets, but there's a fairly continuous sort of continual line but of density that takes us from planet to star. But the claim is that these are stars. Okay. The first lesson I'd like you to take from this is that when you walk outside at night and you look at the sky, you ought to recognize there are lots of planets out there. There are lots of planets. When I was a kid, we didn't know. We thought, no, maybe there are, probably there are, but now we know. In just a couple of years, Kepler and the other missions have found over 1,000 in the past year. I think the total is up around 2,000 right now. And I expect it'll grow by roughly 1,000 a year. So by the time you youngest folks are my age, there'll be probably a million planets known. Okay, but what about life? Okay. Let's first ask, could we live on one of these planets? Now, some of these planets are real big. Some of them are small. Some of them are orbiting very close to their star. Some of them are orbiting far away from the star. We have what we call a habitable zone. This is if a planet is orbiting too close to a star, then water will be in the form of steam. It'll be gas. If it's orbiting too far from the star, it'll be ice. So the habitable zone is called the zone where water could exist in liquid state. Now, it might not. Tom, would you give me the next slide here? There. That's this is a 5-meter high mountain or hill on Mars, and in the distance you're looking at Mount Remarkable, I think it's called. Okay. In any case, the Opportunity rover on Mars that's sending back pictures of Mars. I mean, think about it, people. We are looking at a photograph taken on Mars. Okay? National Geographic goes to Borneo. NASA does the same thing going to Mars. Wow. Anyway, Mars is in the habitable zone, but the atmosphere is so thin that it's unlikely that liquid water can currently exist on the surface. But this little hill was a surprise, and to be sure that they knew what they were doing, the controllers of the Opportunity back on Earth said to the robot, drill into the sandstone and see if there's any water in the rock. But it is sandstone. Think about how sandstone is formed, on the Earth at least. Okay? It involves water. And so there's good reason to think that Mars has, at least in the past, had water on the surface. So Mars is an example of the habitable zone. And Tom, if you'll now go to the next one. There's a sampling of planets in the habitable zone. Please notice Earth up there at the top. So some of these are big. Some of these are small. There's that, let's see. We don't have Kepler 78b up there. But you see that there's a range of planetary sizes in the habitable zone. And this, of course, matters because of what's gravity like on the surface. This, as I say, is really just and these are artist pictures, remember. These are not photographs of the planets. This is artist conceptions. Statistics right now are that about 1% of the planets that they're finding are in the habitable zone. So out of a few thousand planets, a few dozen are likely, or a few tens are likely to be in the habitable zone. Thinking about life more generally, we ought to really ask ourselves a question. We don't ask, could we live there? If we want to know, could there be life there? Then we ought to remember that life on Earth is remarkably diverse. There are living organisms that live when the temperatures are above boiling, down at the hot volcanic vents deep in the ocean. There are organisms that can survive in the terrific cold. There are even reported to be organisms living in a lake made of asphalt, no water, no water around. When we think about life, we shouldn't constrain our imaginations too much. Seems to me maybe we should recognize our imagination is limited. Well, in any case, it seems very likely that there are a lot of potential Earth-like planets, and my guess is that there's a lot of life out there too. And one of the ideas that's on the boundary between science and science fiction, perhaps, is the notion that, yes, there's a lot of life out there. Maybe that's where we come from. When we look out at the stars, out in the space between the stars, there are complicated molecules there. It's not just hydrogen and helium. There's formaldehyde, for gosh sakes. There are small amino acids that people see. And one idea is that maybe life on Earth came from outer space. We know, for example, that there are bacteria that are very radiation resistant and so could survive in outer space. There are bacteria that have have been sort of brought back to life from fossilized materials 250 million years old. So there are bacteria that can hang around for a long time. There are bacteria that can stand very, very cold temperatures. And so in the 8 billion years or so of the universe history before the Earth was formed, maybe life began somewhere. And when the Earth was formed, landed here. There's even an argument that suggests that might not be science fiction. earliest evidence we have of some life on Earth is around 3.8 billion years ago. And at that time, in the solar system history, the asteroids and meteors and comets hadn't been cleaned out that much, and consequently the early Earth was constantly being bombarded by meteors. Any life that got started was likely to get wiped out really fast. And so since it seems to have begun right away, the argument goes, maybe it was already there. But as I say, that has the fancy name panspermia. But, okay, so human-type life, other types of life, but what about intelligent life? Okay, intelligent life. The only thing I'll say about that is that you can take part in the search for intelligent life. There has long been a project called Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And if you'd like to let your home computer be involved in checking for non-random signals from stars, you can be part of a worldwide network that's analyzing signals from other stars. Thus far, all we've found is static. But one day, maybe we'll get the blip, 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 okay? And I'll give you the, if you're interested, I'll give you the website. Okay, hang on just a second. We ought to ask, why does this matter? Why do we care? Well, most of us enjoy listening to family stories, our own stories and families of others. That helps us feel that we're part of something bigger, a human community. It seems to me that this search for planets lets us see ourselves as part of something even bigger than we thought. Not just the Earth human community, but possibly a cosmic community. We, everything else, we're all made of star stuff. Our calcium in our bones was born in a star. And maybe we have distant cousins to other places. Wouldn't it be neat to hear their family stories? Okay, so that's big discovery number one of the past year. The thousands of, well, the more than 1,000 new planets discovered, and the promise that we'll be adding to that list on the order of 1,000 planets a year. I think that's marvelous. Okay. There's another story, though, that most of us also like to hear. That's the where did we come from story. There's mom and dad, and then grandma, and the ancestors, and the cavemen, and then those little furry mammals running around under the dinosaurs, and then the bacteria. It's what's our genesis story? Well, the modern story goes like this. So first, this is to set the stage for the discovery. Today, we see the galaxies moving away from us, moving away from each other, I should say. And that suggests that yesterday the galaxies were closer together. And a long time ago, they were very close together. So, observation number one, a long time ago, the universe was very dense. Okay. Well, back in the 1960s, we also discovered that space is filled with electromagnetic radiation, light. In particular, it's peaked in the microwave region. Space is filled with microwaves. In the days that televisions had picture tubes, and when you when all the stations were off and you had static just on the screen, a fraction of a percent of that static was in fact your TV set detecting this microwave radiation from the universe. So we know that the universe is filled with this microwave radiation. But radiation, like gases, cools as it expands. And that means that yesterday it was a little bit warmer. The day before that, still warmer. And a long time ago, it was real hot. So that's fact number two. Long time ago, the universe was very hot and very dense. And so about 13, 14 billion years ago, that very hot, very dense universe was expanding. And that's what we call the Big Bang. Okay? And taking that story right up to the present, the universe expanded, got cooled, got less dense, stars formed. Stars, as Kathy said, were born. They died. While they were living, they built the elements, the calcium, the oxygen, the carbon, the iron. And in fact, in their death throes, they built the uranium and lead and things like that that make up the universe. And about 8 billion years later, the fire mist that we sang about at the beginning, a fire mist, coalesced here into the sun and our solar system and our Earth. And then eventually we came along. So that's the standard story. But there were some puzzles about this picture of the universe. If you look at the universe in that direction and in that direction, pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same. And although you've all heard of curved space and wondered what the heck that was, the evidence is that on the very large scale, the geometry that you're learning in high school is the geometry that Euclid gave us 2,000 years ago, is the geometry that the universe on the large scale behaves. We say the universe is flat. And when I was a boy, the statement was just, well, that's the way the universe is. This is just one of the sort of givens. And so it was a surprise when, about 30 years ago, a bright guy at MIT, I believe, said, you know, he was studying high-energy physics, particle physics, and noticed that one of his theories that he was pursuing would make the universe expand, as the word goes, exponentially. It was called inflation. And that would explain why all parts of the universe are pretty much the same, because in that inflation theory, all parts of the visible universe that we see were, in fact, in causal contact. They were touching one another. The universe that we see today, at the earliest times conjectured by his theory, would take about that much room. Okay? The last third of my little finger here. And that would also explain why the universe is sort of flat. The standard analogy is a good one. If you were living on one square inch of a balloon, when the balloon is real small, it'd be curved. But as the balloon expands and expands and expands, if you're still living on one square inch, it's going to be pretty darn flat. Okay? And the universe, in the inflationary picture, seems to be much like that. Well, the inflation picture, though, so inflation kind of explained what we already knew. We didn't have to say, well, the universe is just like that. We say, well, if the universe was inflating, then it would be this way. So scientists like that. But you can hardly call this confirming a prediction of inflation. But inflation also predicted that in that very early universe, an imprint should have been left on this cosmic microwave background radiation. Tom, would you give me probably the next slide? Hang on, quick comment. The dark blobs in there are places that stars are being born today. And so we can, thinking about life on other planets, well, maybe 5 billion years from now, there's going to be life in one of those things. Next slide, Tom. There. This is in Antarctica and shows the experiment that was mapping the what's called the polarization of the microwaves. And you see that this is a fairly large hunk of the sky, 60 degrees this way and 15 degrees that way. And in that very large hunk of sky, there are these swirls in the polarization of that radiation that was predicted by the inflationary theory. And so that inflation seems to me to be a lot more serious candidate than I thought before. So we've learned a lot. What's there left to understand? Almost everything. Okay. Next slide, Tom. There's a massive galaxy cluster. Everything you see in that picture, every dot of light, well, except for that central thing with four prongs, everything in that is a galaxy, 100 billion stars each. That's what every little point of light in there is. The red that you see is hot gas. The blue is matter that we don't know what is. We can't see it there. The blue is drawn in because of the way light from more distant galaxies has been bent by that galaxy. Next one's Tom. Kathy talked about a supernova. Look up there in the upper left-hand corner. November 2010, there's a galaxy. January 2011, look at that bright spot that wasn't there then. That bright spot is almost as bright. It's putting out almost as much light as the rest of the entire galaxy. That's a supernova. And by studying those supernova, we've discovered that the universe is expanding faster and faster. It's accelerating. We don't know why. Today, we know that we don't know what about 95% of the stuff in that whole universe is. Almost everything is left to be learned. And so, I'm going to conclude, Kathy, don't worry. What do we make of all this? Here's what I make of it. We are part of the universe. The atoms in our bones were born in stars. We live. We create meaning in love, in family, in music, in art, in science. We create meaning. And since we are part of the universe, this meaning, this art, this love, all this is part of the universe too. The universe is very big. The individual atoms are silent. But these atoms, I, Larry Weaver, these atoms can and do choose to see the universe as great, even possibly friendly. a universe in which you and I can feel at home. We belong. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. Absolutely. I have one last statement that, oh, it's not here. Never mind. While we're getting ready to sing our final hymn, there's a great paper that came out over 50 years ago by Giuseppe Coccioni and Philip Morrison. And in it, they had a mathematical formula that said, we should search for intelligent life. And it was the first time somebody ever said that. And they said that the reader may seek to consign these speculations wholly to the domain of science fiction, but we submit rather that the foregoing line of argument is consistent with all we now know. And they said, the probability of success in finding this intelligent life is difficult to estimate, but if we never search, the chance for success is zero, which I think is pretty cool. All right, and please join us in our ending song, number 27, I Am That Great and Fiery Force. Thank you. Have a beautiful day.